There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Spring is my favorite time to start a new workout routine. With the weather warming up, it feels easier to get into the rhythm of things. Whether you have 20 minutes or an hour for a Pilates class or outdoor guided walk, Peloton has everything you need to help you get going. Get a head start on summer with Peloton at onepeloton.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more, with Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Girl, real talk. This whole it's new year, time to reinvent myself trash is not the vibe for 2024. You can find someone who loves you for you, as you are. You don't need to read a stack of self-help books, only eat sad salads, or like start meditating at 5 a.m. to be ready for dating. So yeah, my advice is to download Bumble and find someone who embraces you the way you are right now. Let me know how it goes.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
How about if I throw out a few things and you tell me what sounds interesting to you? Threshold moments. Probably the most obvious one that I wrote about was when I left home, which you mentioned, the decision to go to college. I don't know if I knew I was on a threshold at that moment fully. I didn't know what college was. So there's not a grand story there. Like, well, I knew education was important and I just had this conviction to follow it no matter what. I didn't. I was like, that sounds better than working in this junkyard, which is miserable. So I'm going to go there. You sit all day, right? And read books. That sounds fine. I don't know how inspiring it is, but let's see. You'd mentioned religion because I grew up very religious. I grew up Mormon, kind of a more extreme version of Mormonism. And then I stopped being Mormon when I was, I must have been around 21 or 22. That was a slow, gradual process for me, though. There wasn't really a moment where I, you know, in the morning was Mormon and then in the evening wasn't. It was an incredibly slow over years kind of change, but we could try to talk about that. Or probably the more significant one for me, the weightier one, the heavier one, is kind of like when I stopped being religious, and that, similar to losing my faith as a Mormon, was a really slow. It's such a process. You know, nobody wakes up on a Tuesday morning and thinks, today I'll become estranged. Like, it's very slow.
My name is Jordan Kistner, and this is Thresholds, a series of conversations with writers about experiences that completely turned them upside down, disoriented them in their lives, changed them, and changed how and why they wanted to write. Hi, everybody. Jordan here. Welcome back to Thresholds. I hope that this recording is finding you well and healthy and safe and full up with good snacks and things to see, read, listen to, watch. And I'm so excited to add to that list of entertainment this conversation that I had with Tara Westover, the author of the memoir Educated, about her childhood and young adulthood as the daughter of Mormon isolationists in Idaho.
a quick primer on that book for anyone who hasn't read it, though it would seem that most of America has read it. But in Educated, Tara describes growing up really isolated, really off the grid. So her family lived in rural Idaho. She and her brothers and sisters did not get birth certificates, did not go to the doctor, did not go to school. The first time that Tara ever set foot in a classroom was after she had decided to leave home, having secretly studied to take the exams that could get her into Brigham Young University. And so I was really excited to have this conversation with Tara because I thought that her book was so full of the kinds of seminal moments that we talk about on Thresholds. And I thought perhaps going into this conversation that we would be talking about her decision to leave home, because that in her book is one of the biggest moments of departure and before and after. But something really funny happened in this conversation where I asked Tara what she wanted to talk about. And she said, oh, we could talk about that. Or we could talk about this. Or I guess we could talk about this third thing. And then it became very clear that the third thing was the real amazing shit. Am I allowed to say shit on this podcast? Whatever. Fuck it. It's my podcast. And that's a pattern actually that I've seen in a lot of these conversations with writers where people often come in and they think they have a subject that they're supposed to talk about. There's kind of an obvious threshold that they feel they are expected to recite on. But actually, if you poke a little, there's something kind of like niggling around at the corners of their minds that is the real live spot, the real humming, vibrating, cool, liminal thing. And I'm hesitant to make any kind of pat metaphor out of this idea that the threshold you're not thinking about is the one that's really the most important. But I do find it kind of a neat pattern that in a lot of these conversations, the most fertile spot is the one that hasn't necessarily come across most strongly to the reader. What Tara wanted to talk about wasn't what I thought she was going to want to talk about based on having read her book. And that's become one of my favorite things about these conversations. And so maybe I will formulate this as a wish for you if you are listening. I wish for you that you get past the first and the second ideas in conversation with whoever you're talking to these days and get to the third one, get to the real shit. One note about this recording is that Tara very kindly invited us to her home, to her apartment in New York, when we did this recording. So the sound is going to be a little different. It is not in a recording studio. We have the occasional sounds of her amazing dog. We have some Manhattan sound. And I like to think that that just adds to it.
I just have the one name. My name's Tara Westover. I don't really think about it. How would I introduce myself? I just use my name. I feel like everything else comes in time, right? I maybe wrote a book. I also have a dog. You know, these things accumulate over time. But I don't have a thing I say when I introduce myself that's like, hey, I'm Tara and I'm super into fishing, which I'm not really, but even if I were, I wouldn't. There was definitely more of a moment for me when I was at Cambridge. And I'd been trying for a really long time to make a relationship with my parents functional. And I did not make a decision to become estranged from them because there's no way I would have ever chosen that at that time. But I did make a decision to take a year and just not have contact with them. That was the way I thought about it. I would never have been in the headspace to explain to myself that I was choosing estrangement, but I just really needed a break. I just couldn't do it anymore. And so I decided that I would just take a year from them. And I wrote them and said, I'm going to take a year and we're not going to have any contact. And I'm going to see how I feel at the end of it. And that was definitely a change, a huge, huge change from everything that my entire approach to my parents before that was try to make this work at any cost, no matter what I have to do, I'm going to make this functional. And that was probably the first time I said, I'm not sure I have control over this, or I'm not really sure that what I do is going to be able to fix this. I don't know. I think when you're a child and even a younger person and you have a really unstable relationship with your parents, it can feel like, or it certainly felt like to me, that the quality of my relationship with my parents was entirely dependent on what I did. So if they were upset with me, it was because I wasn't being the right kind of daughter. So my dad and I would have these fights when I was working for him in this junkyard about it would be hot and I would wear these t-shirts, but I would roll the sleeves up, you know, so they were like sleeveless shirts. So I would roll them. And that was just definitely not allowed in my family. And so we would have these little kind of turf wars over, you know, 2 inches of skin on my arm. But they were just ridiculous fights that we would have. And I think later when we would not get along, I would think, oh, if I was more modest, if I was following the church better, if I was being a better daughter, then the relationship would work. And I think I really had always believed deeply that there would come a time in the future, at some point in the future, and this was maybe my true religion, that my parents and I would be at peace, that my father and I would have a peaceful relationship and we'd get along. And then, you know, disaster happened and it became kind of clear that just might not, that future was probably not going to happen. The big disaster that hit my parents and our relationship was my brother. I had this older brother who just had a lot of problems and really needed help, but my parents just refused to see it. And around, how old would I have been? I used to know this chronology and I stopped talking about this stuff and I've forgotten it, but I guess I would have been in my early 20s when my sister said, she approached me and said, we need to talk to our parents about Sean. He's dangerous. We need to do something about it. And so we did. And for my parents, I think that was the ultimate thing they could not deal with. So I had this brother. He had a lot of problems with violence. He had a lot of problems with women. And they were just not able to hear that. That was not something they could hear. You know, I talked to my mother briefly or had little hints of conversations, but yeah, when I confronted them in a real way, and it was started by my sister. She talked to my mother first and then I talked to her. That happened at Cambridge. And so I was a long ways away, and you know, it was one of those, there's an alternate reality where that happened differently. And when I first told my mother, she took it really seriously and she believed me and she said, yeah, everybody knows that this has been a problem. And she apologized in a way that to me was really moving, because I think when I was younger, when I was a teenager and my brother would be behaving in this way or doing these things that were, you know, violent and upsetting, and he would call me terrible things. And his nickname for me was whore. Which is, that really imprints on you when you're 15, 16 years old and you've had a certain kind of religious education. And so I think I'd always kind of imagined that my parents knew about this and that they were okay with it, and that was because they just felt that that was just. They thought that that was fair, that that was happening, or that it was okay. And there was a kind of magic that happened when I told my mother this, and she, you know, she wouldn't have said, oh my God, because Mormons don't say, oh my God, but she more or less said, if I were going to sum up her reaction, it would be, oh my God, that's unbelievably bad, and I'm so sorry, and I really wish that I had been a different parent to you. And I think there was this kind of glimpse of everything working out, and like they were going to be sorry, and then he was going to get help, and everything was going to be put back together, and as if it had never been broken. And then that future kind of vanished because my father just wouldn't deal with it, just would not confront the reality. And then my mother, who ultimately always followed my father when he decided he didn't believe it and that I was making it up, or there was a period where he said I was possessed. That was his explanation for why I was saying what I said. That just vanished, you know, that whole of the future vanished. But it vanishing did not mean that I didn't still believe in it pretty deeply and keep trying to make it come to pass. And the fact that I had been so close to having it made me believe in it all the more because I'd seen it. I knew it was possible. And so I pursued it for probably another year or even maybe 2 years where my parents actively believed I was possessed by a demon. And I was still trying to see them and convince them that that the relationship was good and that I was good and that I was someone that they wanted and loved. And I think the threshold moment for me, there was no part of me that was willing to give up on that future. But I had reached such an unhealthy, miserable psychological state that all I knew was I can't do this right now. So I need a break for a year. I should need a break. I'm going to clear my head for a year and then go back into the battle. Only I never did.
When did that occur to you? Like, what happened that you finally arrived at the thought, I just need a break right now?
Probably the best way to describe it is a mental breakdown. I think I more or less had a mental breakdown. I was a PhD student at Cambridge, which if you're going to have a mental breakdown, that is a really nice place and time to do it. Like, you know, it's very convenient to be a student and have a little stipend rather than a job. Because, you know, if you're a PhD student, you can just kind of disappear for 3 or 4 months and have a breakdown. And, you know, you don't get fired and you don't lose your housing and the world doesn't come crumbling down. So in retrospect, I say it sarcastically, but I also mean it very sincerely. It's a wonderful time and place to completely lose your mind. Like, if you really need to do that, and I really did, go to a PhD. It's a good time to just fall apart.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Big box retailers, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a bill in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. Senate Bill 1838 would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, visit handsoffmyrewards.com and tell them to oppose credit card routing legislation paid for by the Electronic Payments Coalition.
Just so I have the chronology right, did you have your mental breakdown as a PhD student conveniently before the moment when you said, I need a break? Or did you say, I need a break so that I can go away and do this?
The mental breakdown happened for a while, and I was kind of in denial about it. I mean, things that now I say them, and it sounds so insane that I had no idea. I thought, oh, I'm struggling a little bit, but I'm fine. And but yeah, the kinds – I didn't do any work on my PhD for the better part of a year. And I would have these – I can really only describe them as night terrors, where I would just wake up in the middle of the night and I would be having some really intense dream about my – usually about my dad pursuing me in some way. And I would wake up in the street. You know, I would not wake up in my room. I would have, and my lovely boyfriend at the time, Drew, would be like running after me, you know, because I would be running down the road, just screaming, running from this dream I was having. I would wake up maybe half a block from my house, having gotten out of bed, gotten out of the room, gotten out of the apartment, gotten out of the building, and be in the street, and Drew would be chasing after me, you know, like, wake up, wake up. And I did that for a while. Before I realized, oh, I'm not well, actually. I really need help with this. And yeah, it sounds so obvious I was having them. I was also watching about 20 hours of TV a day, which, you know, why that didn't clue me in that I wasn't well is another good question. But I think it really came to a head. I think the nightmare started when I was with Drew, and then it did. What happened is I went to Harvard for a fellowship and Drew went to the Middle East. He did a Fulbright. And that's when things got really crazy. That's when the 20 hours, Drew would have noticed if I was watching 20 hours on TV when we were together and would have intervened. But after he went to the Middle East and I went to Harvard and I was living on my own, and that's where the distance became non-optional. Like I needed, the way I would think about it now is that I felt like I had this incredible amount of control over my feelings, which was a point of great pride for me at the time. I thought, I'm fine because I can control how I feel all the time. And then what was happening was that I could not control it when I was asleep. And so I started really dreading going to sleep because it was the one time that I would, this kind of things would break through, and I would have to feel how I actually felt because I wasn't in control of it when I was asleep. And now it seems like, oh, you needed to lose control a little bit. That was what needed to happen. But at the time I thought of it as kind of a failure. Like I couldn't control this anymore. And I felt like I was supposed to be able to. I thought being able to control it meant that I was okay. And it's taken me a while to realize locking away things that you need to feel, even if you can control them, it's not necessarily mean that you're okay. It might be the exact thing that means you're not okay.
So when in there did you think, I need to write this email to my parents?
I wish I had a really good dramatic story.
You don't need to have one.
They were all pretty dramatic, but I don't remember why. There was just one that was enough. It was dramatic enough. It was actually before I went to Harvard. So I was still, Drew and I were living together in the UK, in Cambridge in the UK. And I don't know. I think it was just after one of these, I just woke up after one of these nightmares. And I think for me, it was that loss of control was really terrifying. I hadn't yet learned that loss of control is a step that you take on the path to something like healing. So I thought that the loss of control was bad. And in my mind, I was going to get the distance from them so that I could regain the control and be fine again, which is not how I would describe healing anymore. But that's certainly what I thought I was going for at the time. So I think there was a point where I realized I'm losing my mind. Like, I'm losing my ability to deal with this and control it and keep it at bay. So it did not feel optional, I guess, is how I'd put it. It felt like the thing that had to happen. It wasn't a good option. I didn't like it. I felt an indescribable amount of guilt about it. You know, just did not feel like a thing that you're allowed to say to your parents. But it was just necessary. It just needed to happen.
Did they write back to you?
My mother did. My dad didn't. It's funny. I can't recall what the email was precisely. I think she more or less begged me not to do it. And but I think I'd lost faith I'd lost a little bit of faith in that the resolution was possible. I guess lost faith is maybe the wrong term, because I think of faith as you should have faith in things that are good to believe in. But I actually don't think believing in that was good for me. There's a line that I read in a book recently where someone said, sometimes you might have to give up on the myth of a good childhood in order to have a good adulthood, which is not exactly applicable to this situation, but a little bit applicable in the sense that I think I needed to give up the belief in that other future. And probably in another version of the past, but especially in that version of the future, I needed to give up faith in that in order to have faith in something else, in a different future that didn't have that, and start actually trying to imagine my life, a life that would be good, that I would want, that might not be the life I would choose, but that didn't have my parents in it.
Was there a moment when you realized that it was going to be more permanent and it wasn't just something you were going to do for now until you got control of the situation again?
I think, you know, what happened is there was just a year where I didn't talk to them and I didn't write them and I didn't engage with the situation. And I went to a fair bit of therapy and I tried to write my PhD and I just tried to get a grip, more or less. I was just trying to get a grip. And I didn't think about it. I don't think I thought it would be permanent. I don't think I never could have done it if I thought it'd be permanent. The guilt would have crushed me. But at the end of the year, I felt so much better. And I felt as close to peace as I ever had in my life. And I think what's important about the year is that it just established for me that another life was possible, that I could have a year without seeing them, without talking to them, and I could build a life that was worth having, even if it wasn't the life I would have picked. It wasn't the ideal outcome, but I could have a year and I could be on my own without my family, and I could have a life that was good. And it was good. And I mean, I was still struggling, but compared to the year before, it was so much better. And when I got to the end of that year and I started thinking about what it would mean to pick back up with the relationship, the only thing I could say about it is it felt tired. Just this overwhelming feeling of exhaustion would come over me. It's just like, I can't do that. I just can't do it. And so that's probably at the end of the year is when it started to occur to me, what if this is an answer? What if this thing that I put in place to be temporary, just give me a couple months to like recover? What if that's the answer for me, is to just live in this permanent state of, because the point of the year was to take care of myself. That was why was I have to take care of myself for a year so that you can beat me up again. And then at the end of the year, I was like, but wait, what if I just kept taking care of myself? What would that be like? And you could make a whole life out of taking care of yourself and not continually subjecting yourself to this old war. You know, you could just do that. And that was kind of a little bit mind blowing for me to think, yeah, what if this could just be my operating principle, that I will do this because it's because I need it, and not worry so much about what I owe to other people, and just think about myself. Sounds very selfish when you lay it out like that.
I mean, less so when you consider how, like, what how you're defining self-care in this moment, which is to say, like, I'm going to not put myself in a relationship or in a situation where people are saying horrible things to me.
Yeah. Or there's danger of violence or like all the rest of it. But no, you're right. It's but I guess to me, it sounded very selfish. Now it sounds a little bit more common sense. But at the time, it sounded, and I'd never been able to consider that before. What if I just live my life saying, I have the right to pursue happiness and I have the right to insist on my own safety. Like, these are non-negotiable things for me. And what if I just started making decisions where those things are not on the table? Those things have to be a given. And what's possible if those things are a given? And the answer was I could not have any kind of regular contact with my parents. That was the answer. If I was going to insist on safety, there could be no contact with my parents because there would be contact with my brother. And that was a bad idea. So it sounds like for some people, that would probably be very obvious, that those principles. But for me, they were not. And I think for a lot of people, they're not, actually. You grow up and you have a certain – I tend to think people who've been in toxic relationships – that sense of self and that sense of having a right to self-care is what gets eroded. Like, that's the thing that gets taken. And the only way to restore it is to try to get it back. But it's, you know, for those people, for me, it was really tough. And so I think that threshold, that moment of saying, oh, I'm just gonna have a year for myself, but then it's gonna be, I'm gonna go right back to the, It was the only way that I could do it, was to tell myself it was temporary, even though it's now been, you know, probably seven years or something. You know, it's been a chunk of time.
Do you feel like that changed the way you became a writer, or you decided to write about the experience? I'm like interested in the connection between deciding to take your own needs and safety seriously and the fact that you then wrote this story, authored this story in the way that you did. Do you think you would have written the book if you hadn't had that realization or had that moment?
No, definitely not. I think I'd had professors in college tell me I should write. Mostly, I think they were basing it on the fact that I'd had a very weird life And they thought, oh, you've had a weird life. You never went to school. You were raised by these radical people. You should write a book about it, obviously. And I just felt so guilty even thinking about it. I just thought it would be a betrayal of them or something. And I thought about it for maybe half a second and then just recoiled, you know, in horror at the idea. So that was my position for a really long time. I think later, I still think it's very complicated writing about people. And I think especially people who are alive and people that you care about, people that you love, or at least that you remember loving. I think it's an incredibly complicated thing, and you can't pretend like it's not an ask, and you can't pretend like it's not affecting them. That's a cop-out. It is. I think the only defense for nonfiction, really, of any kind, is that you say, my needs and ideas and experiences also get to be weighted here. Like, my need or desire to tell the story is weighted against your need for me not to tell the story, and you have to negotiate it. And it's not perfect, you know. I think for everybody, telling your own story, you're kind of telling the stories of other people, and there's no way around that. Just like there was no way around me saying, oh, I have an obligation to my parents because I'm their child, but I also am a person and get to look after myself and get to set certain rules around what self-care looks like for me and what my boundaries are. And I think that there was a relationship between those things where it wasn't the case that I felt like my parents' feelings and needs didn't matter. I still feel like their feelings and needs matter very much. But I started to be able to put my own wants, needs, feelings onto the scale as well and try to make decisions based on both and not just theirs, which was not intuitive for me for a long time.
So how long did it take for you to even get far enough along into that train of thought to be able to write it down?
Well, writing is a very harmless act. You know, you're writing it by yourself in a dark room. So, and I was always writing. I wasn't a writer. I had no intention of being a writer, but I had kept a journal from the time I was very young. So I was writing all this stuff anyway. And I think the decision to try writing it as a book for me had a lot to do. I remember thinking, I can't really write it because I can't expose my family that way. They won't like it. And I remember thinking that then it was just a dead project. There was nothing to do. And then I think a couple things happened. I think my parents had convinced a lot of people I was possessed. So their version of the story had really taken hold because I was gone, and people hadn't seen me in years. And so a lot of people where I was from, my parents' explanation made as much sense as anything. I ran off to what they thought, you know, socialist country, and, you know, lost my mind or something. It was a very convenient story. And so I think part of it was I wanted to tell my side of it. But I don't think on its own that would never have been enough on the scale. That would never have been enough. I think what I was thinking about were that period when I was at Cambridge and I was at Harvard, right before I made the decision to not see my parents for a year, that year off, my break that I took. There was just like, I felt so isolated and so just the shame I felt was intense, you know, just that if people knew that my own parents, I remember just thinking to myself, how could anyone think that I'm a good person if they know that my mother does not think I'm a good person? Like, this is the person that has to believe in you. And if she thinks I'm possessed, then how could I ask anybody to have any faith in me? And that feeling was so strong for me that other people, how could anybody trust you if they knew that you couldn't get along with your family, was so strong. I just remembered wishing so much that there were people that you could look to and who would kind of admit to having some of these struggles. And I especially just wanted to see somebody who was okay, who'd been through, so it just seemed like they were all right, maybe. It would have been really helpful for me. And And I just wondered, why don't people tell these kind of stories? A lot of the stories that I read, memoirs I read, and there's some exceptions to this because there always are exceptions, but the ones that I came across in movies or books I read were either these unbelievably kind of, you know, Hallmark story. It ends perfectly. There's a lot of drama, but then everything comes together and love triumphs over everything and forgiveness and all that. And that felt really out of reach for me. Or you get the kind of opposite, which is that genre where people have long ago separated from their families and now they're just documenting how awful it was and all the reasons that they did that. And I think I have enormous respect for both types of stories. I think they have their place for people in different periods, but they didn't resonate with me at all. You know, I was in the no man's land in between where what I felt was not that I hated my family and they were terribly abusive because I wasn't ready to use that word yet. And I also didn't feel like, oh, it's fine. We're all going to recover and hold hands and dance in the field. Like, that was not going to happen either, although I would have really liked that. I was in this weird third place where what I felt was like, I love my family. I think really well of them and I need to get the hell away from them. And that book I didn't find so much with somebody explaining why their family was great, why they loved them, why those relationships were so compelling, and then explaining this is why I had to go, even though it was a loss. It was a real loss. I'm not glad that it happened. I'm not glad I had to say goodbye, but I had to say goodbye. And so I think that there was an element of loneliness to it that I felt like there's a reason to write this story because I really wished I'd been able to read it. So there was this kind of sense of trying to write it for a version of myself that no longer existed. And I think, I don't know how often writers do that, they're maybe actually writing to rescue themselves in some way. I think I was writing to try to rescue this older version of me and anybody else who might be in that position. And so when I put everything on the scale, okay, in order for a book like this to exist, it's not perfect. Like there's not a perfect answer. If I tell this story, it's complicated for people in my life and I have to weigh that against my need to do it and the possible benefit of it. And maybe through distortions of my own mind, I decided it was worth doing. But it's not uncomplicated, that decision. And I'll be struggling with that decision for a while yet, I think. I think I had a belief when I wrote the book that I think maybe the book is founded on a false idea, which is that I think I really believed when I wrote the book that if I could reason out what happened and the choice I made, if I could think about it, if I could intellectualize it or conceptualize it in the right way, that I would be fine. You know, like it would stop torturing me and I would be at peace with it. I could be at peace with the whole thing if everything that happened, all the choices I made, all the choices other people made, that I would be okay and be peaceful and be whole if I could intellectualize the story in the right way. So I think that there was an element of that. If I could just put everything in order and say, this is what happened and this is why and this is the decisions people made and this is what was going on with them, that then it would feel like it made sense to me and then I would be okay. And I think there's that helped. You know, it definitely helped to try to make it make sense in some way. But now I have a different view of, I don't think you can just intellectualize those kinds of things and relationships and problems and memories and, dare I say, traumas. I think that intellectualizing them is not going to get you where you need to go. But it was helpful as a first step. And I never meant the book to be permanent, which is a weird thing to say, but I guess people write memoirs overwhelmingly when they're old, or let's say older, and sounds better. They write it at the end of their lives, and I really, really did not want to do that because I felt like the books I'd read about estrangement that people wrote when they're older, people are so settled with that decision by that point. You know, I hope when I'm 65 or 70 that I'm not still hand-wringing about this, you know, that I've come to terms with it. And that story will be so different told by an older person than someone who's still wrestling with it. Just like any novel, point of view is important. And a memoir is no different. Whatever age you write it at is going to have a huge impact on the story that you're telling. Like, think about if you were writing about the first time you fell in love and you wrote when you were 25. Say it happened when you were 17. You write the book when you're 20 versus when you're 70. It's a totally different story. You know, one is like you're seeing it through the prism of whatever life you had after and all the relationships, children, whatever your life's been. And the other one is going to be much more recent, present. You're not going to have that perspective. So they're different books. And I think the prevailing belief with memoir has been that the older is better, that you want that perspective of seeing your whole life through the prism of everything that came after. And only with that grand perspective can you then write about your first love. That would be the prevailing belief in memoir. And I think it's just fundamentally and quite obviously wrong, because we don't think that about novels. We don't think, well, what would be really be ideal is if all the novels were written by 70-year-old men, like, or women either. Like, we don't believe that. They would all have a very specific flavor. So why we think that with memoir is peculiar. And I felt like specifically with something like Estrangement, the prism of having hindsight and knowing how the story ends is problematic, because what's hard about Estrangement is not knowing how the story ends and is not being at peace with those feelings at all and not knowing if you made the right decision and if you're going to regret it and having really unresolved feelings. That's what estrangement is. It's unresolved feelings and uncertainty about the future and still trying to work out the past. It doesn't have the finality that a book by an older person would have. So I fully believed when I wrote Educated that in 10 or 15 years I would really hate it, because I would feel differently about not just the writing style and the sentences, which you hope you get better as a writer as you get older, but just I thought the whole sentiment of it, I figured would shift and I would no longer identify with it, which has already started happening. And but I knew that, and I decided that was fine. You know, it's an artifact of a moment in a particular kind of emotional struggle, and it's not the end. It's just a snapshot. Some people will identify with that snapshot and some people won't. I don't always identify with it. So, you know, sometimes I read, I've done a lot of therapy in the last year and my feelings have evolved. I moved on from the intellectualizing of the story, and I've tried to, you know, use therapy to start dealing with my feelings about the story. And by story, I mean my life. yeah, spoiler alert, am I still here?
Thresholds is a production of LitHub Radio. We're produced by Drew Broussard and Justin Alvarez. Music by Laura Faye Oshavood of Arthur Moon. Our art is by Kirsten Huber, and special thanks to Farrar, Strauss, and Giroux. I'm Jordan Kissner. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at jordan.kissner. See you next week.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.